Welcome to the Sketchy Podcast. My number is 14.
I'm Mr. B.
Today we're actually going to have a little history lesson, if you will, because I've been watching a lot of documentaries and reading a lot of articles and about the wars. Like, I don't know if you noticed, but a lot of the podcasts have had the topics such as war on. It's on my mind.
There's a lot of wars happening.
There's a lot of wars that have happened in the past, and I kind of wanted to try to paint a portrait of the flow of all of this so we can kind of bring it to today. Because, you know, we don't want to just talk about history like it don't mean nothing. No, it's got to apply to today, yo.
Are you saying history is bound to repeat itself?
Yeah, there's some kind of slogan about that. I don't know. Maybe I should learn it. Something about it. If I don't, it might repeat itself. Something like
this
that.
This is war.
That's going to be our topic. But first, what are you drinking? Yeah, first you. What is that brown shit you're drinking?
Well,
it's weird. It looks like pee for someone who's slowly dying of Taipei, you know, virus or Taipei snake or whatever they call it that bites you.
I don't know what that is, but that sounds freaking horrible.
Yeah.
Anyway, the drink is a sort of a modified Negroni template, one of the simplest and, in my opinion,
you can't say that on this podcast.
Delicious
bro.
Cocktails.
You can't say that on this podcast.
What?
You, the N word, man.
The Negroni word. It's an Italian word. Give me a break.
Oh, I see.
So basically, it's one of the simplest and most delicious cocktails if you like bitter things. Three ingredients.
Oh, so that basically no one.
Equal proportions. It's normally made with some kind of gin, some sweet vermouth, red vermouth, which is a fortified wine, and a really bitter liqueur called Campari made from the Kenoto fruit. Maybe you've had that soft drink Brio, that ultra bitter.
Yeah, that disgusting.
Crazy so, one. So I made a modified one. I call it the Oslo Negroni. Instead of gin, I'm using aquavit. It's spicy. It's a clear, strong. You'd hate it.
God, I would.
It tastes less like juniper berry, that pine flavor, if you will, and more like caraway seed.
Oh, my God.
I know, right? So you got to be into that.
Okay,
I'm using a very light sort of fortified wine called Lillet Blanc.
Yeah.
Instead of the vermouth, and I'm using an Italian. I guess Campari's Italian too. I'm using a different Italian liqueur amaro called Vecchio del Capo. It's more citrusy.
Why is it that when you're saying Italian, when it's a drink, you got to say it like a big weirdo? Italian? Who the fuck are you, pal? What is this?
Hey, I'm just saying.
Okay.
Anyway, so it's the aquavit is a traditional Christmas beverage in Norway, and I'm drinking that.
All right.
Today.
Now,
before
you make me fall asleep here, Professor, I got one question for you because, you know, you're talking about bitterness for all of those who like bitter.
Mm-mm-mm.
Let me ask you a question. Let's say you have a bad habit, like, I don't know, biting your nails or something. What's the flavor they put on the nails to make sure you don't do it?
Campari.
Must be Negroni flavored.
Yep.
Yeah, basically. I don't want it. As for me.
So, what are you drinking?
I am drinking.
Let me guess, Russian Standard.
So, it turns out that Budweiser has a mark of beer for the people who aren't willing to pay up for premium Budweiser.
Oh, really?
Prices. Yeah, this is Busch beer. So
is the same as Bud, only...
Yeah, it's Anheuser-Busch, guy.
Right.
This is the Busch in Anheuser-Busch, all right? So this this is, I don't know, the runoff, who knows what the fuck, or what
Down
the deal
Mountain
is.
Beer.
It could possibly be due to the fact that it is 4.7% alcohol, which is not a popular percent in a province that tends to have beers in the 9% range here. Like, it gets really strong up here.
People don't still buy beer based on percentage, do they?
Oh, my God. You know, you're an alcohol snob, and you always laugh when I ask you the first fucking question, what the percentage is. But you got... take a step down your fucking ivory tower, boy, and realize that, yeah, for the majority of population who like alcohol for its deleterious effects, sir, percentage is everything. Everything.
But who's counting?
Yeah, why would there be anything like kind of 100 proof available at a liquor store? Oh, for fine connoisseur. 90% alcohol content
always,
is not for the connoisseur.
I'm always pleasantly surprised by the, you know, marketing copy on these really cheap beers. This one is all natural aging. Using quality ingredients.
Right. Well,
I guess I'm not so impressed.
There's a pattern that you notice with cheap labeling. And actually, you're aware of this phenomenon. You're the one who brought it to my attention. It turns out that if I'm designing an ad and I want people to click on it, one of the old tricks is to make sure that the drawing is as shitty as possible.
Right, a little bit off kilter. Yeah. Maybe poorly animated if it's an internet thing.
Now, but although this phenomenon is known, we don't actually know why, but I have a very strong theory as to why that is. And the reason is kind of based on, go to your store, any store that you see, and you're always going to see that every product is tierized in about three categories. The first category is the premium product, which looks always shining, beautiful. The colors are patented. The fucking logos are solid. The next ones are sort of like the cheaper, trying to be like, they're the medium price range ones. They're the I'm not getting as much, but hey, I'm not the third category, which is the fucking shitty ones.
At least I'm not the third category. Exactly. It's the second category.
And McDonald's understands his principles forever, which is why they always have three prices for their meals.
Oh yeah, you know what? You're right. You have like the deluxe, AAA, mm-hmm. Kobe Angus blend, massaged in a bathhouse.
Sure.
Which is like the $9 burger, right?
Whatever.
There's the Big Mac, the $6 or $7 burger.
Mm-hmm. And then there's the
flat as a pancake.
No frills.
No frills. You
kind of burger. And the reason is because the kind of consumer that exists, that it's fully represented in these choices. Now, if I was going to make an off the brand style beer and I was going to design a logo, it's very important for me to not look too professional or too good, because if I do, then instantly I'm going to scare away my fucking consumer base, who are fucking broke ass people who are looking for the cheapest brand.
So now that we're focusing on this can of beer,
mm-hmm.
I'm noticing the mountains are sort of poorly sketched.
Yeah.
There's a very odd looking
low definition,
low def,
no contrast
eagle that looks like it has a broken wing.
There's barely any contrast.
It's caught in this big letter A as a trap.
This actually breaks a lot of design rules. So let me explain one design rule that is breaking. So it is possible for you to have one color when you have an image. But when you do that, you have to kind of try to cheat the edges, right? You have to use vastly different shades of that same color in order to present a false representation of difference in color. It's like the same way that you can make gray look like a ton of it. Yeah, 50 shades even.
shadows or contour lines or depth or something. Like, sure. It fools the eye, right?
Exactly. But in this one, as you notice,
I'm not fooled at all by
near
that.
The top, actually, it almost perfectly blends with the background, which totally washes it out. But again, this may be a brilliant move on this part, because it is also, it kind of also blends in with the logo for Busch Beer, which is very hard to see again in contrast with this. So nothing pops out. It's flat. The entire thing is fucking flat, despite it supposedly being a kind of 3D image.
There's a couple weird things. I guess on top they're trying to go for that two or three shades of blue without much... I guess it's called dithering, where you kind of use dots to blend different colors.
Oh, yes, yeah.
But on the bottom of the can, they're using total dithering to fade in this other...
really poor effect.
Where the wheat is kind of soaking.
It's a nasty effect, especially...
And who puts a gold crown on the bottom of the can?
But also,
that don't make no sense.
Take a look at this. I want you to look at the dithering effect from where it's low to medium to high density. There's almost... It's so jarringly,
poorly done.
Yeah, it's so poorly done that there's almost no blending. But again, this is brilliant, because you want it to look cheap, yo. It's
like a mind worm. It has to be just off enough to make you remember.
Mm-hmm.
So the last thing, Busch, the name strikes me as strange spelling. I suppose it's German or something. Busch, B-U-S-C-H.
Well, it's the Anheuser-Busch family.
So you'd think
the Germans
that
who had immigrated to America and set up beer empires.
It's not how like most Americans would spell the name Busch anymore. So it's kind of, it's curious, but I'm surprised they draw attention to it again in the second slogan, cold as a mountain stream, smooth as its name.
Yeah.
Very weird. It makes me reread Busch and I don't want to.
Yeah, so that's what I'm drinking.
Yep.
That's... a poorly logoed beer.
the beer equivalent of one weird trick ads on the internet.
But even those...
linguists hate him.
Even those people don't really fully understand why it works. It just works. And we know this about human nature. It's a kind of... Imagine we're in the future, like fucking hundreds of years, and we haven't blown ourselves up, and it's some kind of future where we're flying around in spaceships. No, do you not think there's going to be one version that barely holds together? The super fucking broke-ass version, which we could easily break and send your ass into space? Don't you think they're going to sell that version?
Aeroflot.
And then there's going to be this
program.
The super fucking nice one. I mean, even in a so-called Enlightened Age where we'll escape our bonds, we're still going to be the same fucking monkeys, man. We don't change. We never change.
I'll go for the cheap future drug. Thank you very much.
That is our future. Anyways, speaking of future, or really, well, that's a poor segue, because I'm talking about the past now. I wanted to kind of make a correction first, because I'm not sure, but I think I made a mistake on one of our podcasts where we talked about World War I, where I think I disastrously said that France had kicked Prussia's ass in one of those mistaken your brain farts things. So, And what I wanted to do is I wanted to do a show to correct that giant mistake so I don't look like an idiot, but also because I didn't realize how important that conflict really was as I was trying to study, you know, other conflicts, which kind of made me realize, you know, I've been studying history all fucking wrong. Like, the way that I've been instructed, and probably most of you have been instructed, is a broken fucking system of learning. You know why? Let me ask you this question. Imagine I was trying to get you to imagine 5,000 years of existence. Mm-hmm. Should I start 5,000 years from now, or should I start where you exist and move backwards from there so I can at least give you some fucking context so you can feel the journey and the time and the distance, not have to experience that in a microsecond where you start in the past with something that's totally disconnected from you?
I see what you mean.
Like, when we do a family tree, we start from us and then we move our way down, right?
Because it's relevant to you.
It's very relevant. And
there's a chain of connection to follow.
Yeah, and the crazy thing, though, is that part of that chain, what's really amazing when you start to take this approach of saying, I'm going to move down the chain, is the chain gets smaller and smaller and smaller. And so there are fewer people involved. There are more. You suddenly realize, oh my God, I'm descended from partially this weird tribe and this other weird tribe that warred each other but totally also banged each other.
You're a descendant of Og?
Yeah, right.
Me too.
But I felt like, again, when I was approaching my study of conflict, I was, you know, trying to study it. I wanted to really understand the formation of Europe, and that's complicated if you really start from the medieval age to getting to today, because it is constant war, constant groups of tribes that fight each other, get wiped out, then to get conquered, and then that empire falls, and then other small groups come in. It's nuts. Like, there's a conflict that happens every decade and a half, at the very least, major conflict.
I guess you could say, like, talk all you want about various political systems in each country, but they all have this, or most had this, perpetual war machine or war clock in common.
Yep.
So you can't really talk about, I don't know, this peaceful time without also contrasting it with the need to have a conflict to get it started and a conflict to end it.
This is why we're going to start, strangely enough, because I wanted to talk about the Franco-Prussian War, but then I realized that I couldn't really talk about that without mentioning some of the other wars that happened in the past too, because on some of the other podcasts I had mentioned that some of the wars, like especially World War I, I had mentioned that it was really one of those deals where it was the invention of kind of like the mechanization of war, if you want, like creating a situation in which by the end of the First World War the focus was on from manpower, strictly speaking, to manufacturing. Like, if you could out-manufacture your opponents, it didn't matter how many fucking soldiers you had. It was just more about the means of production of your country rather than putting a fucking bayonet in some guy's hand and saying, kill that motherfucker, because that's just not how war was evolved. But before it got to that, really, in that in-between period where war started to really turn what I would say scarily professional, there was a kind of in between time, and what that time was like is, imagine, like, you've probably heard of the Ottoman Empire, right? You heard that it crumbled in the Second World War, but what you didn't realize is that it was on the verge of collapse in like the 1830s, and the only reason that it was being kept up is because the Russian ambitions to grow their empire was like, you know, we have something like 2 million Orthodox Christians that are living under Ottoman rule, and they're second-class citizens. And we can make this play of saying to the Ottoman Empire, we want the rights to the Holy Land. which becomes this interesting and rather kind of climactic excuse, if you want, for nations to start to fight each other. And specifically, Russia has these ambitions because, you know, it has what you would think in a modern, at least at that time, was an important army thing, which is that they just had numbers. They just had sheer volume, and everybody was really scared of them. I mean, this is why France and Britain, I mean, enemies, like basically the commanders of each other's armies called each other the enemy. Like, they had just finished a bloody war, like, just not so long ago. Like, one of the commanders had lost a limb at Waterloo, you know, fighting the French. Meanwhile, he's got to ally himself with the French now against the Russians. And what they have to do is they have to lend, quote unquote, support to the Ottoman Empire. Because here's the thing. Russia figures, you know what? I'm going to claim this land, and nobody's going to do shit, because who's going to rise up against a Christian to defend a Muslim? Like, he figures his gambit is like, no one's going to stop me here. This will be like a new holy war and what have you. But Austria is like, if that happens, you know, we don't have any buffer. So even though Russia gambles on the fact that Austria will say, you know what, we don't want to be involved, they actually do get involved, which is bad news for Russians. So Russia basically finds itself against a ton of other nations, and they're fighting all of these battles. But the deal is, Russia just sucks, man. I mean, most of the armies suck. The commanders themselves, in some of the, you know, they've had the experience of maybe a dozen men before the war, and all of a sudden they're giving like 64,000 men. You think that that's maybe a little quick on that promotion?
They sure grow up fast.
Yeah. Mm. And let's just say that Russia had not had a lot of, a lot of discipline in training their men and really making them prepared for what war was going to be.
So was it just overconfidence, basically?
I think it was.
And pride and belief that they could just snatch it up.
And I think it's sort of like the Russian ethos is they always think, you know, they have large ambitions, but...
Oh, yeah, expansion.
They don't land. Have a lot of, attention to those small itty-bitty details that really matter in a civilization. Like, for instance, making sure that your population doesn't starve to death, which has happened so many fucking times that, you know... It's kind of sad, like Russians killing Russians, you know, in various conflicts. But this is one of the things where you start to notice that conflicts, especially in the 19th century, are kind of slowly leading from one to the other. Like, a good example is, we're going to go back to the Crimean War. So now you have like this alliance, right? That's fighting the Russians. And also the Turks are there. But, you have no idea how poor the Ottoman Empire was. Like, everybody's impression when they just arrive there, they're like, okay, we're going to help these guys out, is they're all beggars. Their economy is fucking to shit. It's just a disaster area. And they're not even helpful because they just commandeer the most important buildings without asking. And then they just kick every fucking buddy out. They just say, you fucking get out of here. You can't even... rule yourselves, but they don't do jack shit to help them. So they're basically just there to watch. I mean, this was the last war where people brought their wives to war. You brought your fucking wife to war, man.
Why?
Because first of all, civilians were targeted. This only happened actually during the Franco-Prussian War, where it really started to get crazy. We'll get to that later. But anyways, I don't want to talk too long about the Crimean War because this could last all night. I just what I want to talk about is that the events that led up to it, okay, the people that started that event and how they felt justified and what they thought. Like, everybody was totally into the romance of war back then. I mean, it was partially fed also by the fact that during I'm trying to remember which previous conflict the Russians had fought in. I can't even remember which one that was, but they had, some of them had witnessed it as artillerymen, and what they could do is they saw the battles without ever facing any danger. So a lot of men sort of came back from some of these conflicts with these really glorious stories of war, of talking about the beauty of watching. Tolstoy was actually in one of these conflicts. He talks about the beauty of watching men kill each other at night, because he's not involved. He's an artilleryman. He fucking sees the things in the distance.
Spectator war.
Yeah. And there were, I mean, the Napoleonic War were still spectator wars. People would sometimes go to the battlefield to watch that fucking shit go down, you know? Because who would think about shooting the civilian? Everybody was in really obviously colored clothing. You could not miss them. It's almost like going to war with a fucking target on you, you know? And again, this is sort of like the attitude that people have mostly going into the Crimean War, but it's starting to change. Because now this is actually where you're starting to see the use of trenches and things like that, because the first uses of it, because people realize that with these new guns and things, you can get mowed down, yeah? And it's not easy to fucking get people off the battlefield. And Russia, in the Crimean War, lost most of its people, as did most of the other countries, to just disease. They didn't even have doctors there. I mean, you know Florence Nightingale? Yeah, that's where she got her fucking shit started, because, hey, somebody needed to do something about all these dying people that nobody gave a shit about. Hey, well, that guy's over there in a corner bleeding to death. Well, he's of no use to me. Like, maybe that's not the right way, because now he's causing sepsis. He's spreading it around. And, I mean, there would be soldiers who would arrive there, and the next day they would already be stricken with disease and dead the third day. Fresh soldiers.
Nasty.
They don't even see one fucking day of war, and they're already dead from fucking plague shit.
Well, war is hell, and some wars are more hellish than others, I suppose.
Well, the one thing that everybody learned from that, though, is at the time, France was like the only professional army. And I mean that. Like, they were the only ones that actually had a full, long-term standing professional army, and that seemed to actually give a shit about what was going on. Like, they actually had logistics. They had, you know, people had, like, designations, fully marked, you know, camps where they would set up and things like that so you wouldn't be lost. The British, meanwhile, are, like, scratching their heads, and they're just like, what are we doing? And meanwhile, the French are doing most of the fighting and also most of the dying, and they want out of this shit. And Austria, too, because they're also doing most of the fucking fighting or dying. So finally, at one point, Russia sues for peace, even though Britain's like, we're just getting started. They didn't fucking do jack shit other than look dumb, you know, and sort of say, I think we could learn a few lessons, derp. Why do we stop the war? This is just getting started. So, But the end of the Crimean War also sort of puts this new emphasis, if you want, on Prussia, which is now starting to kind of, like, I don't know, flex its muscle, man. And this leads me up to what I wanted to talk about with the Franco-Prussian War. So I wanted to mention the Crimean War just so that to say that Russia never forgot that shit, okay? They're still on that. You know, when they're like, oh, why do they want the Black Sea? Oh, I don't know. Crimean War, maybe? Yeah, when all of Europe...
trade. They want something that, you know,
well, that's the original
freeze,
reason
yeah.
why they wanted it. Right back then, it was just about the money. They wanted to open up those ports, but France and Britain and Prussia, what would be now Germany, realize, oh, you know what? Like, this might upset the balance. Russia might get too big and too powerful. So they bitch slapped them. And I'm like, do you think that Russia forgot that shit?
Never.
And for Russia now, because they don't have this justification of, you know, religion that they had back then, instead now it's more like, okay, well, these people are ethnic Russians or whatever. The religion or the justification may change, but the patterns never do. It's the same thing. It's like, oh, we're just trying to protect our people, so we're going to have to kill you. That's the way they do it. That's the way they do it. And Europe definitely does not want them to have control of the Crimea like they would back then. So
Russian expansionism.
The only difference now is that rather than have a conflict with Turkey, or what would have been then the... Well, no... Yeah, because I think they were at war. Now they're actually more allied, but, you know, Turkey. I mean, like, it's like the least stable government in the world. So it's like, I mean, you just flip-flop.
Could go either way.
But the Franco-Prussian War actually is the war that, when I was researching it, kind of, like, blew me away a little bit in terms of, you know how long it was, first of all? It was a year. It was a fucking year. Like, why do you think that everybody in World War I thought this war is going to be over before it even started? Because the fucking Prussians had kicked the shit out of France in a year, stolen $1 billion from their coffers, and gotten, like, two territories, Lorraine and I forget the other one. So, yeah, maybe they were a little cocky back then, just a little bit. But before we get to that's the end. The Franco-Prussian War, what really fascinates me about this is that this is another example of European power dynamics being in danger, all right? So France is now, like, the big dog. They are the Empire of France again, because Napoleon III has now basically declared himself emperor. You know, they tried that whole republic thing and be like, fuck your republic.
We gotta get stuff done. How about that?
And, you know, Napoleon is... the third has like ambitions of his uncle. So, you know, he sets about creating again this sort of professional army, and he wants to put Prussia in its place. But Otto von Bismarck, who's one of the generals of Prussia,
cool name.
I know, he's just a cool, and he's a kind of cool looking guy. He's got a badass mustache, and he is the most powerful man in the world. He controls all the politics. He's the one that sort of like steps in and starts to mitigate the Crimean peace treaty. So, enforced by his will, by his fucking will alone.
Check
sir.
Out his full name and title: Otto Eduard Leopold, Prince of Bismarck, Duke of Lauenburg.
Well,
A.K.A. Otto von Bismarck.
I can only imagine that since the Holy Roman Empire, what eventually became Germany, was made up of so many principalities, how many, like as they were being gobbled up or whatever, how
I'm
many
a
of those
Duke of this, yeah. a Viscount of that.
Yeah. How much you suddenly gain? Of course, obviously these titles don't last, but you know, I'm the High Count of Bavaria. Blah blah blah.
There's still some of that royal. Designation floating around Europe.
Yeah. But so Prussia knows that they're basically, they're kind of number two, right? They know it. They have a smaller army. It's not as professional. But the one thing that Otto von Bismarck knows is he knows war. So one of the things that he does, he actually sent advisors and soldiers to find out how it was being orchestrated. And one of the major revelations that they had was the use of railways and the use of telegraph in war. So basically during the Civil War, America had revolutionized mobilization. I mean, gone were the fucking horse cart shit. In was like massive train lines that they could fucking lay out, right? And you could transport troops, heavy artillery, machine guns. Well, by then they didn't actually have machine guns per se, but you know, like heavy weapons, if you want. Bismarck realized that the key to winning a war was actually really more about mobilization, right? That if you moved fast and swiftly, that you could overcome your enemy even before they knew what would happen. And so he basically figures that what he's going to do is he's going to go right through to take Paris. And this sounds like a familiar plan, my friend, and this is because, it's a good plan. Like, you just, if Paris falls, then everybody will motherfucking fall. Bismarck plans for like 2 years for war. Secretly. He knows it's going to happen because he knows Napoleon III's got fucking ambitions, man. And he knows that there's going to be some kind of play. And Spain, oh man, the amount of times that fucking Spain has caused wars, bro, because of like lines of secessions or whatever. Like, think about one of the great empires that crumbles, can't fucking handle its shit, but has still all this wealth, all this land. You know what I mean? Like a mess. It's like the fucking wild card. So all of a sudden, there's like this potential, there's talk that he might actually be able to make a legitimate claim to it. Of course, everybody knows that if that happens, you know, could you imagine Prussia and Spain kind of allied? So nobody wants to see that happen. And so Bismarck is told that he's given a message to send saying that, no, they're not interested, you know, like the crown is not interested in it and they're not going to make a claim. But he rewrites the message. He rewrites the message to make it sound like they are. And so that enrages the French, who basically decide that they're going to, you know, make a play. But Bismarck is fucking ready for these motherfuckers, my friend. He's already mobilized all these fucking troops and shit. But, and this is the kind of strange thing that I found out during the war, is that for the most part, the French were fucking decimating them. Like, they were cutting them down. They had superior machinery in terms of guns. And they even had a secret weapon, la mitrailleuse. It was so secret, in fact, that you weren't allowed to uncover it. Nobody was like allowed to train with it, which was stupid. So it never got used right. But they had a secret weapon and everybody was really afraid of it, though. The mitrailleuse. And they're like, what is that? Well, it's a gun that can fire like many bullets. It's like the first Gatling gun, if you want. And it's if you should see like the designs for it. It's quite hilarious, like with the little wheels and stuff.
As long as the reputation is scary, then I guess you never really have to use it, right?
I suppose it has. There's always that kind of psychological advantage, and sometimes your enemy can overestimate it and devote resources to try to take it out. But for the most part, it doesn't get used much. And unfortunately, the French, I got to be honest, don't have the same kind of fighting spirit. They have fewer losses, sometimes almost half the losses of the German. But the German, like, It sometimes it seems in wars, it's who's willing to suffer the most casualties? Who's got the fucking guts for this shit? And France doesn't. And all of a sudden, they're retreating. And they capture Napoleon the motherfucking Third. And France starts falling apart. It Third Republic has declared for a little while. There's something called the Paris Commune where people are like, we're going to start our first democracy. We're like a socialist democracy. It doesn't end well. It basically ends in a massacre. And that's the other thing, too, that happens in war. When you lose a war, by the way, civil war is your reward. Ta-da!
Ta-da!
Yep. That's the danger of deciding, oh, I'm going to play around with my country. I'm going to declare war on fucking Prussia, and it's going to change everything. I mean, he went battle head first. Like, he literally went to the first battles. Why do you think he got captured? So fucking, well, not early in the game, but still, he got captured. And you're like, oh, we have your emperor now. What you gonna fucking do? Like, that is embarrassing when your emperor gets fucking captured.
There's a fantastic cartoon showing Bismarck in his post-territorial era where he was he was intentionally excluding France from any diplomacy or trade. And France is depicted as a lonely, crying girl on the side while everybody else is wheeling and dealing in Europe.
They love
Bismarck. They're loving it. The lonely, sad, crying girl.
But this is what I'm saying. Bismarck was the shit. I mean, I don't know why somebody hasn't made like a cool mini series on that. I mean, talk about political intrigue, yo. The political intrigue that shaped the fucking world to be. Like, World War One, World War Two, all of that shaped by fucking Otto Bismarck's. Because the thing was, when France declared war, now all these other territories that were not part of Germany were suddenly forced to ally themselves. Previously, they had been neutral. They wanted their independence. But now it's survive or die. Get conquered by the fucking French or by the Prussians, who are being sort of like wheeled and dealed by Mr. Superstar Otto von Bismarck. You know what I mean?
Man, that'd be great. Von Biz, a Netflix original. It'd be great.
Yeah. I mean, with the mustache alone, bro, the shit you could sell with that. But so, you know, if you listen to the World War One podcast, then I think that you kind of get the idea of what happens when, you know, Germany basically built its modern Munich was built on the money that they demanded from Paris. Or I mean, from France. $1 billion, man. $1 billion. France was broke. They felt that shit. They were broke in many ways. And, you know, it took them a while to recoup. But they, oh my God, they were angry and bitter at their loss, let me tell you what. They were really pissed, which is why they were a very enthusiastic participant in the war, trust me. They, like everybody else, was like, you know, this is our chance to fight back. It'll be over in a few months. And, you know, when the last war lasted a year and was so successful for a country, because it was industrialized, in that 40 years of peace, whatever the fuck that is, it's really just an armistice. The same armistice that existed between World War One and World War Two. It was just an opportunity for both sides to start mechanizing themselves. So
To rebuild.
To rethink their strategies. Because one of the things that happened in the Crimean War, for instance, was that the Prussians had learned the lesson, the tactic that when you were trying to fight, let's say over these trenches, it was a mistake to sort of bring out a bunch of troops, especially seeing as how their guns were inferior. They couldn't reload quite as fast. So what they did instead was they had smaller groups, sort of like small little raid groups that could be easily concealed and make sort of like surprise attacks. And this is the tactic that they would use in the First World War and in the Second World War. So, you know, for Germany, or what basically became Germany, this was the warm-up act that got them. And it was so perfectly executed too, because Bismarck was able to sort of say, hey, France started it, you know? What did we do other than send a threatening message?
Wasn't me.
And, you know, to be fair, France had ambitions. They wanted to be, you know, the new empire. And remember, Napoleon had controlled almost all the major European powers. He had his family, you know, in all of the positions of powers. Like, it was an embarrassment. It was like, imagine some kind of cocky guy who has no noble lineage, which is the founding structure of your entire fucking society for 1,000 years or more, and then all of a sudden some fucking hotshot Corsican knocks it down like it ain't no thing, and then starts setting up his family as like the king of Spain and shit like that. I mean, like, are you gonna take that? Are you gonna really fucking take that? Yeah.
Not on my watch.
Not on your damn watch. Exactly. And you don't think that Napoleon III a bit smelled of that shit? Exactly. I mean, there's some troublemaking stuff right there. But it was also, you know, I guess you could say I don't want to say a precursor, but it just demonstrates as what the point that I was trying to say before, which is, you know, do we really have periods of peace? Are they just instances of armistice? What we have peace now, or do we? Like, think about how conflicts now, or how wars now, prepare countries for the next war. So what does a Syrian war teach the modern, you know, for the modern lessons for the next war and things like that? If you think that there's not going to be another one, if you think that we've ended all war or major wars, I don't think that that's a very realistic idea. I mean, I think that we're drawn to it. I think that human nature is characterized by war. And I mean, like, civil war is another aspect of war, but it's not always caused by wars that you started. It's just that sometimes everybody fights each other too. Like, pick up a fucking weapon and you smash somebody else on the head, and boy, it feels good for some people. Really feels good. You could talk. There's a few documentaries, actually. CBC did this in the 80s. It was very controversial. They interviewed veterans of the war, and they talked about some dark shit. And yeah.
You don't often hear those gritty stories.
Yep. About, like, some of those guys who's like, yeah, I killed that guy. Felt great. So
could it have been the years of training to do such an act?
Could it be that every fucking psycho serial killer should have actually been enlisted in war?
Finally, a use.
That, no, I mean, if we are so characterized by war, then yes, that would be a use. You can't all be doves. There's got to be some fucking killers out there, because realistically, whoever has decided to delineate themselves in a new tribe, they've got their psychos too, and maybe they're training them. I mean, you don't know.
Right.
You don't know.
Right.
Train up your psychos, folks.
Weaponize your psychos. Oh, boy.
All right, let's move on. I think everybody's got enough history for now, right? I think that we've bored everybody. Let's talk about something more relevant to today, and let's get out of this war bummer mood
What a downer. Such a Bismarck.
I know. Trying to manipulate things.
He left his Bismarck on history.
He did leave his Bismarck all over that history. Yep.
All right.
All right. With that, I'm number 14.
I'm Mr. B.
Go fuck yourselves, everybody.